Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Tony Moore is a cultural historian, commentator and documentary filmmaker with a special interest in Australian pop culture, artistic bohemia and labour politics. He is commissioning editor of Pluto Press Australia, prior to which he was a program maker of the ABC TV, where his last documentary was Bohemian Rhapsody, Rebels of Australian Culture, which is now the subject of a PhD he's completing at the University of Sydney. But tonight he's going to talk to us about, I'm not sure, because I don't have the list in front of me, but the topic is, does the left have a sense of humour? Or why the left needs a sense of humour? Anyway, Tony will tell you all about it. Tony, thank you.
Thank you, Jared, and thank you for inviting me tonight. Since I first agreed to come to talk on the larger topic of humour and satire in Australia, does the left need a sense of humour, I've dreaded the chaser crashing our proceedings. It struck me that it would be an irresistible target, and I have to say, Jared, since your article today in the paper has done nothing to allay my fears, should they appear, I will throw to the chairman.
That's okay, and I'll throw them out.
You can all hear me?
Yeah.
Fantastic. It's just a tiny bit tall.
Yeah, I'm
just
going to help.
If we can get it out. Yeah. Does the left need a sense of humour? I was moved to ask this question after being named and shamed in the New Statesman by left agony aunt John Pilger in an article about Aboriginal deaths at the hands of white justice called Mourning a Secret Australia. My crime, an Australia Day feature on the vexed issue of our national character, had quoted my belief that any Australian patriotism should be first and foremost based on taking the piss, on laughing, not just at oneself, but at the powerful, whether upper-class Brits or the PM himself. Pilger took me to task for these remarks and advised me that until we whites give back to black Australians their nationhood, we can never claim our own. I remembered then that in 1999, the satirical Struth magazine, which I co-edited, had nominated John Pilger for our Australia Most Earnest contest. Now, if we've got time at the end, I'll take you through some of the other contestants in that competition. Pilger prefers to mourn victims, but I asked him to consider the role of satire and humour as a way of commenting on and indeed changing society, and put my contention that from the convicts onwards, humour, irony, the send-up has been one small weapon of the powerless, and a weapon in the armoury of the oppressed, the outcast, or those simply fed up with cultural uniformity. Rather than merely presenting Aborigines as victims, Pilger might give thought to their use of wry humour and irony against authorities as a form of resistance. In fact, Mary Kalantzis once observed in her PhD thesis that the Australian sense of humour probably owes as much to the Aborigines as to the Irish. It's no accident, I told Pilger in a reply in the letters page, that our current government is an especially humourless lot, and I believe the progressive forces here do better to join with the many ordinary Australians spanning many ethnicities in taking the piss out of them. Pilger's holier-than-thou sanctimony has its fans, but to me he seems more like one of Manning Clark's straighteners, the puritanical punishers who come not just from the right, but also from the left. Think William Lane, for example, who was one of the founders of the ALP. Means shape ends, and if you can't laugh, I don't want to be part of your revolution. Has political correctness cruel comedy on the left? Happily, in this country, there's been a long and cheeky dalliance between progressive types, those who Clark called the improvers, and humour. But at its best, this comedy is not left-wing agitprop, a message-by-numbers satire beloved of undergraduate review, street theatre and cartoonists in the trot street press. In looking at satire and humour down under, I want to consider its political implications, not so much from the standard left-right spectrum, but as a more anarchic agent of subversion and social catharsis. A space where rabble-rousing lefties meet a style of libertarianism that can also be associated with right-wing satirists, notably Barry Humphries. This homegrown comedy tradition, which I call the larrikin carnivalesque, had its climax in the Foster's-guzzling, all-chundering Barry McKenzie movies of the early 1970s. But it stretches back into colonial Australia, and it's alive and cheeky in Howard's Australia, as the popularity of the chaser testifies. They're not at the door yet, are they? Commissioned by the satirical UK Private Eye magazine in the early 1960s, if you'll allow me, I'm going to talk a little bit about the Barry McKenzie movies, which I dearly love and is the subject of my book. Commissioned in Private Eye magazine in the early 60s to write a comic strip about Australians in Britain, Barry Humphries came up with a young, uncouth, innocent abroad, Barry McKenzie. Bazza was vulgar and irrepressible, perpetually sucking on, and I quote, ice-cold tube to Foster's, trying unsuccessfully to get a Sheila into a game of Seek the Sausage, and chundering at will on unfortunate pawns who crossed his inebriated path. McKenzie the Innocent Abroad goes forth amongst the Brits, oblivious to his surroundings, immutable in his larrikinism. The character allowed Humphries to have a spray at everything he disliked about Australia and England. And boy, did he dislike a lot. Banned back home, the script became a cult hit in Britain, running from 1964 to 1971. And against the odds, and with the help of director Bruce Beresford and producer Philip Adams, was made into one of the first films of the Australian cinema revival of the early 70s. Now, more than just ribald farce, the movie was important because it reinvents the local comedy tradition to interrogate key tensions in Australian culture. This is a serious bit, folks. Between the province and the British metropolitan centre, the artist and the working class, the wowser and the libertine, authority and unruliness, and cosmopolitanism and white Australia. Later we'll get on to the vexed issue of Humphries and race. As brought to life by Barry Crocker, McKenzie is a foil against condescension and cant, whether published overtly by the English ruling class or more subtly by the counterculture, media professionals and officious state functionaries. In the sequel, which happens to be my favourite, Bazza holds his own, a more overtly political edge is reflected in its pursuit of authority figures, from police to ambassadors to Soviet dictators, but also in the mockery of fads obsessing the young cosmopolitan middle classes, the old and new left, and its sustained satire of the Australian cultural renaissance of Gough Whitlam, who is sport enough to appear in the film Judane Edna Everidge. Now, they say never work with dogs and children, but also don't work with new technology. It's probably old technology, so I'm hoping it will work for me. We might dim the lights once I get it working.
I've written this book, The Barry McKenzie Movies, to give it my passion to fans of Australian movies and people that follow Australian culture. I explore the great Australian icon, Barry McKenzie.
I really needed that. Well, as dry as a dead dingo's donga, isn't it?
We also have a look at why Barry Humphries, Bruce Beresford and Barry Crocker, this is help from the producer Philip Adams, were able to produce such a transgressive and subversive comedy.
Barry McKenzie wore a wore a double-breasted navy blue pinstripe suit. He was, in fact, an innocent, adrift, treading warily the moral quicksands of the swinging life. He hated the English word.
Brits couldn't even spell it. Bloody pommies wouldn't work in an iron lung.
He couldn't get a girlfriend.
How come a good-looking, clean-cut Australian like me gets so many knockbacks when some dirty, greasy, Ikey no-style bastard like you scores it for a meat traveller with an abo in an airborne dummy?
It was constantly rattling.
You're a colossal looking shit on all right. And to tell you the truth, I'm not really up to root the hair in the barbershop ball.
In a quest for spending on all kinds of adventures for what he desired most, ice-cold Foster's.
One of the most inventive things about the Barry McKenzie movies is the lingo.
Excuse me, Lesnar. I reckon you're looking all right in that outfit.
Both Barry Humphries and Bruce Beresford set about recording the schoolboy slang of playgrounds, the lingo of building workers, but also made up a literary phrases like Point Percy at the porcelain.
I thought, kiss my bum, if that shiver wouldn't bang like a dunny door.
I think every Australian child should learn this language. That'll stop American cultural imperialism in its tracks.
Did
you get a who's who of British and Australian comedy? Get the likes of Spike Milligan. You get Peter Cook. And then you get Clive James, and you get people like John Clark.
Remind me of something there, mate. Yeah. Yeah, some of those shitters who don't look so like a great little performance.
Yeah. You know, Stacey and Upton's films were not only great comedies, they also had a lot to tell us about Australian culture.
We're back in Oz now, we've got culture up to our arseholes.
Used by Humphries to show his disdain for working-class Australians. But seeing this movie as a teenager in working class Dapto, we rooted for Bazza as he gave snobs and posers an earful or an eyeful. Barry McKenzie remains funny, not just because so many of the cows are still grazing in our cultural paddock, but because the standoff between an arrogant, complacent elitism and an uncontrollable democratic larrikinism are perennials in Australia's creative and political life. In this struggle, I'm unashamedly on the side of Bazza and his mates, and believe the film's hostility to power and position makes it a radical and life-affirming film, rather than the conservative misanthropy that Humphrey's left-wing detractors find in much of his work. Now, this form of dissent has deep roots in Australia's folk memory, where it's often referred to as our larrikin streak. In translating McKenzie to the screen, the producer, Philip Adams, says they were conscious that, quote, Australian cinema has a larrikin tradition dating back to The Sentimental Bloke, to the early films of George Wallace, to the Dad and Dave series. Their original larrikins were working-class delinquent youth who disturbed the peace of city streets from the 1870s into the early decades of the 20th century. While becoming the focus of a conservative and often anti-Irish moral panic, larrikinism also came to be admired by artistic and political libertines in the 1880s and 90s as a marker of nonconformity, earthy humour and disdain for authority. The larrikin streak was found in the journalism, bush ballads, jokes and cartoons of the early bulletin, especially its discoveries Henry Lawson and Norman Lindsay, and shapes both the Ned Kelly and Anzac legends. Between the wars, larrikinism typified the big city tabloid sensationalism of Smith's Weekly and the comedy of humorist Lenny Lauer and especially performer Roy Rean. A larrikin libertarianism was strong in the two bohemian subcultures of the late 50s and 60s through which the young Humphreys and Beresford moved, the Melbourne Drift and the Sydney Push. Some people claim the Melbourne Drift was only invented after the Sydney Push book came out because they were jealous Sydney was getting all the attention. We can discuss that later. An exaggerated larrikinism became an integral part of the expat bohemianism in London. Humphreys, Beresford and Adams called an emerging mood in their generation of artists in the 70s. Suddenly, ochre humour was everywhere, from Williamson's Stork and Don's Party to Tim Burstall's album Purple to Paul Hogan to ABC's Auntie Jack. Now, the term carnivalesque was coined by Soviet literary academic Mikhail Bakhtin to refer to a topsy-turvy spirit of riotous festivity, famously unleashed in the carnivals of Europe in the 15th and 16th centuries, in which the lower orders deployed misrule, play, humour and vulgarity to subvert authority, if only temporarily. Think of the Feast of Fools in Victor Hugo's Hunchback of Notre Dame. While it was more safety valve than revolution, Bakhtin argued that carnival nevertheless had the potential to make the rulers squirm with discomfort by ridiculing the mystique of power. Now, he must have been onto something because Stalin exiled him to Kazakhstan. I'd like to stop off now at a few points in this tradition I call the larrikin carnivalesque, basically my favourite ones. Now, one of the great colonial satirists was immigrant journalist and writer Marcus Clarke. You probably all know him as author of The Term of His Natural Life. Now, he was a celebrated wit. He drank, gambled, argued and scandalised his way through Melbourne in the 1870s, setting up a string of bohemian clubs. The first was the Yorick, outraging respectable society and keeping one step ahead of the creditors. And he was dead at 35 in 1880, partly from drinking too much. He also famously tried opium and hashish for his as a journalist to write about the effects, so that might have had something to do with the early death. Clarke came to prominence in his 20s as a columnist in the conservative newspaper, The Argus. Scalpel in one hand and rapier in the other, young Marcus carved out a journalistic niche for himself as the peripatetic philosopher, a slightly bemused, cynical observer of the mock heroic goings-on of Melbourne society, producing sketches that anticipate Humphrey's monologues by a century. His targets included sharebrokers, new chums, our boys, the working man, politicians, squatters, art connoisseurs, journalists, sporting men, Victorian ladies and larrikins, all accompanied by their own peculiar slang or jargon. The politics of the time was dominated by the, quote, parochial committee man, who is, quote, intensely respectable and intensely narrow-minded. He is solemn-looking, and it is only when he begins to speak that you find out his intellectual incapacity. He is always proposing economical tricks. He is bland, pious, and is known in political circles by some honest prefixed abbreviation of his baptismal name. Sound like a Prime Minister we all know? Clark had little time for zealous radicals either. He condemned colonial republicans as kid-glove Democrats who profess to admire Cromwell, talk about liberty of the soul, equality of honest men, but would disdain to nod to their tailor if they met him in the street. This reminds me of another, of an ex-Prime Minister we all know. In a mock pamphlet, The Future Australian Race, sending up the latest racial theories, he predicted that by 1977, so he's writing in 1877, by 1977, Queensland and all hot areas above a certain line would be authoritarian potentates, like those found in Latin America and the Orient. Remember, we had Joe by then. While the South will be a Greek democracy, the intellectual capital of this republic will be Melbourne. However, the fashionable and luxurious capital will be on the shores of Sydney Harbour. The present custom of drinking alcohol to excess will continue. It was with the Bulletin founded in 1880 that a radical, more democratic, grassroots Australian style of humour began to flourish. I should say Clark was a high Tory and of the imperial governing class that never had a cent to his name. And in Australia, he did the reverse. He became a radical for living here, or a crusader. He was anti-materialist. He was a liberal moderniser. He picked one fight too many. He got into a fight about whether or not how many Aborigines had been exterminated in Tasmania. He told the Anglican Bishop of Melbourne that God was no longer relevant. And I think his final fall, right, then he started defending convicts. And his final fall of grace, from grace, was contriving a hoax about the Melbourne Cup being broadcast by a great optical eye into the offices of the Argus, and they were stampeded by people wanting to see this futuristic vision. I like Clark a lot. But you know what I like about him is he became a bit of a radical, but he preferred the joke and the jape to polemics. The Bulletin's editor, J.F. Archibald, another guy I really like, made a virtue of tapping the energies of the bush and urban workers as a market, but also as contributors. And from this interactive community emerged larger-than-life writers as diverse as Henry Lawson, C.J. Dennis, Steel Grub, Banjo Patterson, Joseph Furphy, and the cartoonist Norman Lindsay. Favourite targets were the capitalist fat man, politicians, parsons, wowsers, blue stockings, and especially other media. Despite a strain of sexism and racism in its humour, which incidentally it shared with just about everything else, including the labour movement, the Bulletin of the 1880s and 90s was radical in its political championing of the Bushmen and causes like One Man, One Vote, Republicanism, unions, the new Labour Party, and reluctantly female suffrage. But as Sylvia Lawson has argued, it is in the magazine's carnivalesque disruption of expectation and its topsy-turvy mockery of authority, blending of genres, the interplay of short comic pars with cartoons, its parody of competitor publications, and blurring of readership and contributors that the Bulletin was most subversive. And it really does reward one to go and look at the old bulletins, because the extracts you get in articles don't give it justice. It's the total package that's the funny thing. The O'Malley hoax of 1944 built on Sydney literary bohemia's love of japes and stunts and was a perfectly executed satire of the serious young zealots of the burgeoning modernist movement by James Macaulay and Harold Stewart, centred on the Angry Penguins Journal. In April 1944, Penguin-in-Chief Max Harris received a manuscript of unpublished surrealist poems penned by an unheard-of poet and mechanic named O'Malley, who had recently died and left his work for his sister Ethel to find. Convinced they had discovered Australia's T.S. Eliot, I guess, they published the poems in Angry Penguins magazine to great fanfare, simultaneously in Melbourne and New York. Even the hoaxes blew the whistle. Macaulay and Stewart were fine poets, and the poems aren't half bad, but they are nonsense, raw coded nonsense, which they said they plucked out of various books on bogs in New Guinea, and they were soldiers at the time working in the Victoria barracks, and there's a wonderful book on that called The Irrimalian Affair by Michael Hayward. But they're fine poets, and their work can today be appreciated as accomplished parody and performance art. The invention of the prim Philistine Ethel Mallee anticipates Edna Everidge by a decade. Now moving on to Edna. Barry Humphreys, the 1950s university student, was neither a romantic nor a political radical. He combined the dadaist desire to shock and subvert with the dandy's ease of superiority and social climbing. As a student performance artist, he would throw up fake vomit on tram stops or pretend to be a hopeless blind man on trains just to see people's reaction, a famous grotesque work was the art sculpture Puss in Boots. And his first published work, Bizarre, was full of various freaks of nature. Paradoxically, Humphreys was fond of aestheticism, the late 19th century art movement, which emphasised a refined and distancing taste and had its apotheosis in Oscar Wilde. Now, just as Wilde used theatre to observe the manners and classy idiosyncrasies of his time, so Humphreys honed his writing and acting skills to picking on the suburban, middle and working classes. And as Jared reminded me earlier, people below him in social class usually. Though in Barry McKenzie he goes for the very top, as you saw. A performer like Humphreys allows the Elizabeth Bay Dowager or Carlton Academic to cross over class and other barriers like good taste, if only for one nice night's entertainment. Edna Everidge, Humphrey's revenge on the smug and Philistine suburban middle class, first appeared in 1956 as an Olympic hostess, driving an official to apoplexy as she primly rejected all nationalities offered as billets for her Mooney Ponds home. I think Alsatians particularly gave her worries. But by 1965, the left and arts types were also in his sights, courtesy of Lance Boyle, the trade unionist, Martin Agrippa, the avant-garde filmmaker, and Neil Singleton, the beatnik, bearded, left-wing academic, Humphreys observed at the time. Until the mid-60s, Neil's class of Puritan, querulous, turtlenecked elbow, patch pipe-smoking, wife-cheating, wine-buffing, abstract, art-thinking highbrow had been my most enthusiastic fan, eager for a chuckle at the middle-class effusions of Edna, Sandy and other Australians they never met at their own parties. Humphreys imagines that once bitten, the left were shy of him. But I don't think that was so, as the reception to the Barry McKenzie movies would show. Now, in 1964, Oz magazine landed like a meteorite on the media landscape from left field. Its editors, Richard Neville, Richard Walsh and Martin Sharp, had been influenced by student newspapers, rebel pop stars, the British satire boom and the permissive sick humour from the US typified by the rude, lewd Lenny Bruce. Broadly to the left, Oz spoke for anarchic libertine youth rather than the old men who ran the ALP. Oz was amusingly critical of institutions that spoke for a conservative idea of nation, such as state and federal governments, the courts, Arthur Caldwell and Menzies, police and army, the RSL and service clubs. Satire and absurdity marked the magazine out from the broadsheets and worthy avant-garde publications and had more in common with the Phillips Street reviews and the new television sketch comedy, The Mavis Branston Show. Not since the Bulletin had an Aussie publication had so much fun mocking the mass media that surrounded it. Now, the limits of freedom to satirise were tested when the New South Wales Police thrice charged Oz editors for publishing obscenity. The 1965 court finding that Oz had literary merit was a significant victory, encouraging to others working in journalism, theatre, film and fiction, as well as to mainstream media, to eschew the customary self-censorship. Oz continued under Richard Walsh until 1969, eventually collapsing into a new project, Gordon Barton's Nation Review, while Neville and Sharp took the Oz franchise to swinging London, where it provoked another obscenity trial. Now, Neville may have been dragged off to the Old Bailey by the conservative establishment, but his book, Play Power, published in 1971, makes it clear that his brand of countercultural satire was as hostile to the left for being too formal, Puritan and elitist in its politics and too dismissive of the revolutionary possibilities of pop culture. The book was mediated by Guy Debord's Situationist International, one of the more interesting forms of dissent to emerge from May 68. The Situationists, like Humphreys, favoured data-inspired stunts that held mainstream institutions, both capitalist and public, up for ridicule in order that freedom could be won amidst the cracks, confusion and chaos. Debord advocated using the media's power and needs against itself, jujitsu-like. A synthesis of satire and criticism of Australian realities developed in many places in the late 60s. On TV with This Day Tonight, in print with Nation Review, I showed This Day Tonight to my 12-year-old son and he just couldn't believe it. The humour, he said, oh, this is better than The Chaser, and it confirmed to him that Kerry O'Brien is indeed the most earnest current affairs presenter in Australia. We saw it with Nation Review in the late 60s and the Australian Performance Group at La Mama Theatre in Carlton. In its 1969 David Williamson play, The Coming Stork, the intellectual pretensions of the Carlton Bohemia were exposed by the loudmouth, anarchistic, eponymous character, a uni dropout unfit for either the working class or the bourgeoisie. Don's party satirised ageing radicals, dispirited and bitter in the mire of suburban compromise, disorientated by the individual freedom promised by the new countercultures. Geoffrey Searle noted that this generation of theatrical activists brought to theatre a freedom and spontaneity not seen since 19th century theatre at its most popular and least respectable by writing comic, colloquial, anti-authoritarian, satirical and sometimes savage plays. APG director Tim Burstall, who went on to do Alvin Purple as well as Stork, as a film wrote at the time, one of the best ways of getting an Australian audience to accept itself, one of the things we're fondest of is the sender. We're prepared to look at life and laugh at it in a way that we're not prepared to look at our life and be serious about it. Now, once the Gorton government relaxed censorship with the R certificate, which as a child I thought meant rude, and turned on funding for feature filmmaking, the hustle began to reimagine these theatrical innovations as movies, bringing Bohemians and the Burbs together for a laugh and a perv. The ochre comedies had arrived. Humphreys and Beresford, but also Williamson and other artists, looked on the disappearing Australian working man with both satire and nostalgia to say things about a culture emerging from isolation. Bazza, for example, is badged as a relic from a bygone era by his double-breasted suit and especially the hat, and set loose amongst the foreigners, artists, hippies and admin and women's livers that make up a changing world. In Barry McKenzie Holds His Own, tinnies are hurled at grant-laden artists, philistine politicians, blowhard bureaucrats, zealous radicals and especially smug trendies. As you heard, the government's shelling out piles of bloody moolah on any prick who reckons he can paint pictures, write poems or make flaming films. Barry tells Cole the Frog, explaining how drunken film critic Paddy copped $20,000 to come over here just to go to the flicks. I should say that Paddy's played by Clive James, but it's supposed to be a send-up of Paddy McGuinness, who was a film critic at the time, but I think it's a pretty good send-up of Clive James at the time. He's perpetually drunk, and we know this to be so from his memoirs. We also know, like Humphreys, he gave it up. In this film, cosmopolitanism happens in the contemporary Australian Spanish style, and European cultures to be found at the Munich Beer Hall Festival. Interestingly, Bass's Pommy Bastards t-shirt of the first film was now replaced with one emblazoned Commie Bastards. This contempt is rammed home when the communist leaders of Eastern Europe are vampires sucking their countries dry, literally. Given what we now know about Ceausescu, was this too far from the mark? Humphrey slides his critique of Marxist regimes into easy put-downs of the broader Australian left and the Labor Party. An English diplomat grumbles about the ridiculous détente between the Australian government and the Soviet bloc, When Baza and his mates parachute into Transylvania, they pretend to be students from the Bondi Organisation for Radical Education, acronym OR. The government officials who preside as judges of the immigration game show at Australia House are caricatures of the big, fat, middle-aged blokes who run the New South Wales ALP Sussex Street version of Tammany Hall. You're in, they say to the hapless Pong Ma, who has to say the greatest little country on earth is Australian and is Australia and Britain. Is it worth wiping your backside on? But the Barry McKenzie films also go after condescending English toffs and racist yobbos in lynch mob scenes reminiscent of the Cronulla riot. Barry McKenzie holds his own, shows a bunch of white blokes terribly anxious about other races, despite having come from a country in the throes of a massive immigration program and a government pledged to land rights and a racial discrimination act. Baza and his mates don't care much for, quote, abos, heathen Chinese, yellerins, frogs, wogs and dagos. And as Jared pointed out to me, his memoir isn't that nice. There are Irish Catholics on a good day. Humphreys and Beresford's ochres play with the language of the streets and playground rather than the sanitised language of government tolerance programs. Holds His Own makes clear that the old prejudices were dying hard when it has Australian High Commissioner Sir Alec say to a Transylvanian communist who'd like to immigrate to become a Sydney taxi driver, "We don't want types like you undermining our wonderful institutions and unique lifestyle, crawling like termites in the fabric of our nationhood. We got too many chick lovers as it is." Humphreys was never a racist, but he was astute enough to know that many in the Australia of the 50s and 60s were. Rather than ignore or despair at it, Humphreys picks at the scab of Australian racism, ventilating this running sore. And in my other guise as the organiser of Fabian events, we had Philip Adams many years ago oppose the Racial Vilification Act on the same for the same reasons. A conservative contrarian, while many of his generation were moving left, Humphreys nevertheless retained a delight in transgression and enjoys the misrule of the great unwashed. But due to the influence of Protestant moralism and petty bourgeois derision of the modern art that he cherishes, the Australian political right, except for the, for free thinkers like Peter Coleman and Macaulay and the cultural right, and Macaulay actually launched the Baza comics when they were finally unbanned under the Gorton government, the Liberal Party never appreciated the Baza movies, which were attacked for their vulgarity in Parliament by the Snedden opposition, although the first film was funded under Gorton. In fact, someone said to me, probably because they were funded under Gorton. Traditionally, the Australian ruling class was uncomfortable with larrikinism, associating it with Irishness and working class unruliness. The Baza movies, ironically, found their biggest fan amongst lefties, the students and ALP types they mocked. The left of centre historian Manning Clark congratulated Humphreys for catching a type Australians recognise and are really proud of, and so barrack for him as they would for one of their football heroes, Ornette Kelly. I loved it. This left-wing spirit of the brand was strengthened by the association with Philip Adams, who was a well-known fellow traveller and occasional publicist for the ALP. Baz's Pommy baiting played up to a strong anti-English sentiment among some sections of Labor, and following the dismissal, a growing number of Republicans, like if they tell me and my mates at school kind of used it. And I showed this film at my school in 1976. While Humphreys cared little for the It's Time euphoria, Holds His Own is umbilically tied to this mythic period in Labor history. Now, Humphreys' promotion of the carnal, the lesbian Australian life was a natural fit with Labor, then the home of Wags, Mateship and the Long Lunch. In the same year as Baza held his own, Labor nailed its larrikin colours to the mast at the Terrigal National Conference, amongst a frenzy of Hawaiian shirts and bikini-clad research assistants that would have brought a throb to Celeste Patterson's trousers. Less than a decade after Gough's film cameo, Australia elected as Prime Minister a larrikin character reminiscent of Barry McKenzie. Bob Hawke was funny, ochre, and held the Guinness Book of Records for sculling beer in England. Bond, he swore off the grog and before his election victory, counting on Australians' love of a reformed larrikin, and in his new statesmanlike mode was dubbed the Silver Bodgie. The street-talking Irish Catholic Keating was another larrikin in the lodge, famous for translating complex economic concepts into slang. For his own cutting use of the vernacular as a parliamentary weapon, he described the opposition as dogs returning to their vomit, lampooned their free marketeer leader as a feral abacus, and caused a Mackenzie-esque furor in England when he dared to touch the Queen's back. Remember the Lizard of Oz? And larrikinism made a brief comeback in 2003 when Whitlam's protege, the Ocker Maverick Mark Latham, became federal leader. Media and voters are anaesthetised by the quiet of the Howard years were first inspired, then alarmed at the prospect of a larrikin in the lodge. Today, faction control pre-selections sift out the colourful, the larrikin, the eccentrics, for the party hacks and machine men on both sides of Parliament. We live in an age where bureaucrats are drafted as police, where managerialism, focus groups and gaff spotting take the place of wit, passion and ideas. Nevertheless, I take from the era which made possible a celluloid encounter between a PM and Bazza the passionate belief that an authentic Australian leader, especially a Labor one, should be a bit of a larrikin. To smuggle a sense of the carnivalesque, what Keating called vaudeville, into our otherwise materialistic politics. Now, if I have time, I just wanted to talk about, very quickly, larrikin comedy today.
I think we've had that question time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well done, Tony. Thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.